us out and keeping everything rolling here. So I hope you have a wonderful weekend. We'll see you on Sunday down at the Harmony. Otherwise, we'll see you right here on most of this station, WORT 89.9 FM, listener-sponsored Back Porch Community Radio in Madison, Wisconsin, right? WORT Madison. Have a wonderful weekend. Bye-bye.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. There's been a renewed chorus for restraint in the Middle East after a presumed Israeli strike on Iran in response to Tehran's direct attack on Israel. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said America's focus had been on making sure Israel could effectively defend itself, but also on de-escalating tensions. James Landale reports.
In the early hours of this morning, explosions were heard in the central Iranian province of Isfahan. Iranian state media said these were air defense missiles hitting three drones. Some reports suggested they'd been launched from within Iranian territory. The attack appeared to have taken place close to an airport and a military base. Iran claimed there'd been no damage. Tehran seemed determined to play down the incident, with officials not blaming Israel for the attack, instead pinning it on unnamed infiltrators. One official was quoted as saying explicitly there were no plans for retaliation. There was no confirmation of responsibility by Israel's government.
The Belgian ambassador in Kinshasa says the DRC should file a complaint with the International Court of Justice over Rwanda's failure to respect its border. Roxane de Bilderling was referring to UN findings that Rwanda was actively supporting Congo's M23 rebels. Richard Hamilton reports.
The UN says fighting in eastern Congo has displaced more than 700,000 people in the first 3 months of the year. The conflict can be traced back to the Rwandan genocide in 1994. Several Western countries, including the former colonial power Belgium, accuse Rwanda of backing the M23, which Kigali denies. It in turn blames Kinshasa for arming a Hutu rebel group, the FDLR. The M23 are Tutsi-led, and many analysts say Rwanda is using them to protect itself from Hutus who were perpetrators of the genocide, but who fled across the border afterwards.
China's leader Xi Jinping has appeared at a formal ceremony establishing a new cyber force. It would coordinate the military's network information systems. Here's Celia Hassan.
In images released by China's state media, Xi Jinping is shown in a khaki uniform presenting a flag to the newest branch of the People's Liberation Army, the Information Support Force. The defense ministry says it will boost China's capacity to fight and win wars, echoing an order issued by Xi several years ago when he began an ongoing drive to modernize the military and to place it firmly under the control of the ruling Communist Party. Its unveiling comes 1 month after the U.S. was joined by Canada, the U.K., and New Zealand in accusing Chinese state-backed hackers of targeting their governments, journalists, and corporations.
News from the BBC. The U.S. House of Representatives has moved a step closer to approving a much delayed... to get approval for the Ukraine package, despite resistance from the right wing of his own party. The Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk says police have arrested a Belarusian citizen working for Moscow, who ordered an attack last month on a key ally of the late Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Mr. Tusk said the Belarusian had directed the two Poles suspected of carrying out the attack on Leonid Volkov. An Italian court has thrown out charges against 10 defendants from charity organisations who had been accused of aiding people smugglers. The case had lasted 7 years. Danny Eberhard reports.
The Sicilian court's ruling follows a recommendation by prosecutors to drop the charges. The charities have welcomed the decision, but the case, which they say was politically motivated, has left a lot of acrimony. They'd been accused, among other things, of coordinating rescues with people smugglers. Doctors Without Borders said 7 years of falsehoods had now been swept away. Saving lives, it added, was not a crime. Jugend Rettet also accused the Italian authorities of trying to criminalise civilian rescues. The impact of the case, it maintained, was that thousands of people had died at sea or had been returned to Libya.
The electric car company Tesla has recalled thousands of its new Cybertrucks over an issue with their accelerator pedals that could increase the risk of crashes. The recall of almost 4,000 vehicles applies to every one of the trucks that have been shipped to customers since the model went on sale late last year. Tesla has said it will fix the problem free of charge. The futuristic vehicle has faced numerous problems since it was first unveiled in 2019. BBC News.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Just Coffee, Madison's Fair Trade Roasting Cooperative. Just Coffee buys fair trade coffee to ensure equitable conditions for coffee grower cooperatives around the world and roasts locally in small batches. More information at 204-9011 or on the web at justcoffee.coop.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The
no
big sound
change
from
without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
WORT 89.9 FM, listener-sponsored community radio, Madison, Wisconsin. And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am Estee Dinor. As you heard on the news, there are calls for restraint between Israel and Iran. Just to remind you, adding to its unprecedented attack on Gaza, Israel bombed the Iranian embassy in Damascus, Syria on April 1, killing seven members of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, including two commanders and six others. Iran retaliated on April 13, launching numerous missiles and drones, but causing little damage to Israel. And then last night, it would have been the morning in the Middle East, Israel attacked an Iranian airbase near Isfahan, which is in central Iran. And while the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is calling for restraint, we've heard from Itamar Ben-Gvir in Israel that he called Israel's latest attack pathetic. And before that, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has brushed off calls for restraint from close allies and others. So what does all of this mean? Is a Middle East-wide war now likely or more likely than before? If so, will the U.S. become fully involved? What about the threat of nuclear weapons and so on? We have two excellent guests to discuss this with us. Richard Silverstein is an independent journalist who reports on Israeli national security affairs, including the Israel-Palestine and Israel-Iran conflict. He has published the Tikkun Olam blog for the past 20 years. Hello, Richard. Thank you for joining us today.
And so glad to be here.
And also with us is Joost R. Hilterman. He is the program director for the Middle East and North Africa for International Crisis Group. He's joining us from Erbil in Iraq. He has been with the International Crisis Group, which is an independent NGO dedicated to preventing deadly conflict since 2002. Before that, he was executive director of the Arms Division of Human Rights Watch in the 1990s and research coordinator at the Palestinian Human Rights Organization Al-Haq in Ramallah in the 1980s. He holds a PhD in sociology from the University of California, Santa Cruz, and is author of A Poisonous Affair, America, Iraq, and the Gassing of Halabja. and behind the Intifada, labor and women's movement in the occupied territories. He has contributed to the New York Review of Books, the London Review of Books, the New York Times, Foreign Affairs, and other publications, has lectured widely and has taught at Johns Hopkins SAIS. I'm not sure what that is, but Yosh will tell us in a moment. Let's see, his creative nonfiction book, The Resurrected, was published, I'm assuming, in 2023, telling the story of Kurdish genocide survivors. And hello, Yost, thank you for joining us. What are you doing in Erbil, Iraq?
Thank you so much, Steve, first of all, and thanks for having me on the program. I guess I have to update my bio because my nonfiction book hasn't been published yet. I'm currently looking for a new publisher, but it is finished, so hopefully soon. I'm in Erbil, Iraq, because I was attending a conference called the Sulaymaniyah Forum, which is held every year in the spring. So I just came from Sulaymaniyah, which is about 3 hours driving from here, and I'm on my way back home. But that's why I'm in northern Iraq at the moment.
Uh-huh. So have you had an opportunity to feel the mood in Iraq and tell us what it's like there when we think both about the back and forth of Israel and Iran and the attack on Gaza?
You know, it's interesting to see because a number of foreigners who were going to come to the forum canceled. Partly because there was a fear that there could be a direct confrontation between Iran and Israel that would spin out of control, partly because no one wanted to be, trapped in a place while they have work elsewhere. So they didn't want to, because flights get suspended and a number of flights have been suspended. My colleague just couldn't get on her flight today to Vienna, but now she's leaving for Istanbul. So it depends on the airline. In any case, that is the foreigners. But, when it comes to Iraqis, it's like they've seen it all. And so they're not really particularly troubled or excited about what is happening in the region. I mean, there's a bit of concern, but it's not at all like what you would see in Europe or the United States, I think.
Yeah. So one more question. Some of the missiles that were sent to Israel actually came from Iraq, if I understand correctly. Can you explain that?
So I don't have confirmation yet exactly about the trajectory of the missiles, but what I understood, but it may not be correct, is that they were fired from Israeli F-35s from the skies above Syria, and that part of the rocket, whatever comes off, actually fell near Baghdad in Iraq, but so the missiles themselves went to Isfahan in Iran. So there was nothing fired at Iraq.
Uh-huh, okay. And were some missiles fired from Iraq towards Israel on the 13th?
That maybe, but yeah. Also I have not seen any confirmation of that. I know some missiles rockets were fired from southern Lebanon into the Golan Heights, the occupied Golan Heights. But otherwise, the non-state allies of Iran were not really part of the big attack on April 13th that Iran carried out against Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If I might interject myself.
Go ahead.
I have some information about that. A few hours before the Iranian attack, the Israeli attack on Iran, drones from Iraq struck the Israeli Navy base at Eilat. Iraq and Iraqi militia allied with Iran have in the past also participated in similar attacks. So among those targets attacked yesterday were sites in Damascus, a military airport in Damascus, and there were Israeli attacks on the Iranian militia in the Iraqi militia in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Well, Richard, let's stay with you here. This Israel's attack on Iran, as well as the one on the embassy in Syria, is not the first time that Israel has attacked Iran, whether on its soil or elsewhere. Can you give us a background to such attacks in the past? And I would ask you to also include the Stuxnet cyber attack on Iran's centrifuge arrays.
Well, in terms of Stuxnet, it's affected the nuclear plant in Natanz, which is next door to Isfahan. So Isfahan has not only Natanz, but it has a light water reactor that's part of its nuclear program as well. It has military targets that were attacked, an air base, I believe. And it's also a prominent a religious center in Iran. So it was a deliberate target by the Iranians to say to, by the Israelis, to say to the Iranians that we can attack your most vulnerable, your most critical military facilities, and we can cause mayhem by destroying your nuclear plants if we have to, which of course means that Iran is going to redouble its efforts to be able to attack Dimona, which is Israel's reactor. So we have really a tinderbox situation here. This is the first time each party has attacked the sovereign territory of the other, which also creates a new precedent that escalates the conflict. Now, going back to your first question, of course, as you said, there is a long history of attacks by Israel against Iranian IRG generals in Syria and in Lebanon. So Israel has a program of assassinations. It also assassinated, I believe, about 8 nuclear scientists inside Iran who are part of the nuclear program. And Iran mostly acts through its proxies and hasn't directly attacked Israel and hasn't even really attacked individuals, Israelis, as Israel has done. But those proxies, Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen, the Iranian-backed militias in Iraq, and Syria as well, to an extent, are all quite potent enemies of Israel and can exert their force, even though Iran has not until now directly attacked.
Mm-hmm. I want to take a little detour just because you mentioned the assassinations of scientists. When after Hamas attacked Israel and Israel started its ruthless attack on really civilians rather than Hamas, I was one of the people who started calling for ceasefire immediately. And a lot of people have said to me, well, what can they do? Hamas is in Gaza, it's using people as human shields, it's in tunnels, and so on and so forth. And my answer was that Israel has a long history of finding leaders that they don't like and assassinating them or killing them from the air, as they did in Syria, and that if they want... If they're fighting against Hamas, they know how to do that, but they chose to really fight against the population there. And of course, recently have been shown to be correct. You know, Syria, Iran, and Lebanon. Israel has been doing a lot of political assassinations recently. So I just wonder what your opinion is on that. Richard.
You're talking. No. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Well, there is one really simple answer to that question, which is if you want to end the conflict, the armed violence from each side against the other, you negotiate an agreement between Palestinians, Palestine, and Israel, And Israel has refused to do that for decades. So that's the simple answer to that question. Now just go back to a conflict, presuming there's no compromise. I personally believe that according to UN General Assembly resolutions that were repeatedly affirmed, I believe in the legitimacy of armed resistance against foreign occupation. And so I believe that Israel is engaging in genocide, not just in Gaza, but in the West Bank itself. And that's what preceded the Hamas attack in southern Israel. So it's not, these things are not in isolation. So just isolating Hamas and saying they're at fault is misleading, because there's a long history of Israeli provocation, incitement by settlers, the expulsion of Palestinians in the West Bank from their villages. Over 1,000 Palestinians have been evicted violently by settlers. The settlers have killed Palestinians, and the Israeli army has as well. So the Hamas attack was in the context of all of that Israeli violence.
Mm-hmm. Yost, I want to go back to the Israel-Iran situation. For now, though, if there's anything you want to say about these previous questions, you are welcome to offer your opinion. But after Israel attacked the Iranian embassy in Syria, its response seems quite serious, right? 3,000 missiles and drones, but they have warned the United States of it coming, and the US, UK, French, and Jordanians have all intercepted the missiles. And so, first of all, I'm curious to know what your thoughts are about the Iranian response, and then tell us why all these various countries are involved in intercepting and really in the fighting, basically.
So first of all, it was over 300, not 3,000 pieces of ammunition, missiles, and drones.
Yes, yes.
Doesn't matter. It's still a large number. And I think, but it could have been a much larger number, too. It could have been 3,000, for example, if Iran had wanted to, but it clearly didn't want to. From what it looks like, and from also what Iran said, and we don't necessarily have to take them at face value, but they wanted to send a message more than actually hit particular targets in Israel. I think two or three missiles got through, but overall, you know, the vast majority were intercepted or misfired or whatever, mostly even outside of Israeli airspace. So, and I think that Iran knew very well that this would happen, because they have extremely good intelligence, as does Israel, and they know what Israeli defenses are like, and they know what American military capabilities are like. So they expect their weapons to be intercepted. But the point of sending 300 or 250 or whatever is that you show that if you send more, you can overwhelm your enemy's defenses. It is a when you send a swarm, and I'm sorry, I'm not a military expert, but sorry, I get this also from reading the news, of course, but if you send a swarm of missiles and rockets and drones at an enemy, they cannot possibly shoot all of them down. So 300 maybe, but 1,000, I don't know. And then if you add weapons coming from Lebanon, from Hezbollah, fired at Israel, it has also an immense arsenal. If you add that to it, then I think Israel would be in real trouble. And that was the point that Iran wants to drive home. That, in fact, Israel should be careful not to escalate further, because this is what Iran can do. But the game that is on is really to reestablish a mutual deterrence between the two. The question, or the real danger is that, you know, miscalculations happen, miscommunications happen, mistakes happen. And we've seen that. I'll give you one very quick example. On January 28th, The Iraqi group Kitab Hezbollah, which is not related to Hezbollah in Lebanon directly, it's an Iraqi group, but they fired a drone at an American outpost in eastern Jordan called Tower 22. The interesting thing is that the drone entered or attacked the post at the same time as an American drone was returning to base. And the Americans misunderstood, and they thought that the incoming drone was actually their own drone. And so the drone they didn't fire at it. They didn't shoot it down. It went through, and it killed three American soldiers. That is the kind of mistake that can trigger something much bigger. And the United States responded with force at that time and killed one of the key commanders of that group in response. But Iran basically told the group not to retaliate after that, and things calmed down. But you can see in a situation where a number of rockets get through, kill civilians in Israel, or vice versa, an Israeli missile that hits Iran, and not Isfahan, the military base, but Isfahan, the city. End of story. We'll see. It will be very difficult for leaders to and furious publics to not respond. Mm-hmm. That's the danger we face.
Yeah. So, Richard, we have been told that there has been very little damage to Israel, and like Yost has just said, that was the intent. The intent wasn't to escalate. But I read, and tell me if you know anything about that, that the Nevatim air base was struck by 5 missiles, and the Ramon base by 4, and also a military intelligence headquarters in Tel Aviv and a surveillance tower in the Golan Heights were hit. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I can confirm for sure that Nevatim was hit, and the other base, I presume, is the Rimon that you're talking about. These are very important bases. The Nevatim base, I believe, is where many of the F-35 warplanes, U.S. warplanes that Israel has, are housed at Nevatim and at other bases. And so I think what Yost has been saying is accurate, that Iran has provided Hezbollah with 100,000 missiles. So that means that Iran itself has a multiple of that amount. And it's possible, it's capable of firing well more than 300. He mentioned 3,000 was possible, and it probably would be more than that. And we know that Hamas on October 7th fired so many missiles at Israel that, as you said, their defense was not capable of handling all of that, and many targets were struck. So going back to that coordinated layered defense of Israel from the Iranian drones and missiles, we're not going to always have such a coordinated response. Iran basically telegraphed its attack, so there was plenty of time to organize and coordinate this, and so we had French warplanes, British warplanes, we had Jordanian defenses, and we had Israel. So all of them combined to intercept almost all of those missiles. But that's not going to be the case all the time. Iran, if it has to attack for whatever reason in the future, will not telegraph its intentions and will launch an attack, either a surprise attack or an attack if it's been attacked as it was in Syria. So this is another one of these dangers that we have, that Iran could massively attack Israel. Israel, in turn, could massively attack Iran. So we're really on the precipice of an unprecedented escalation, possibly.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain why Jordan participated in intercepting missiles? Jordan, which has a huge Palestinian population, how come they're involved on Israel's side?
Well, I might add that Palestinian population is very angry with the Jordanian response, because they are in solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza, and also feel hostile feelings towards Israel itself. But Jordan has a very long history of collaboration with the Israeli intelligence services. Hamas leaders, there was an attempted assassination in Jordan of Khaled Mashal, one of Hamas's leaders, the king forced the Israelis to provide an antidote for the poison, and Mishal survived. So, and in other instances, Jordanian intelligence has collaborated with the Israelis. So the other factor is that Jordan does not want its airspace to become part of this tit-for-tat conflict. Or Jordan wants to maintain neutrality, or at least a balance of within all the parties that were in conflict in the Middle East. So that's why they were so active in doing that.
Mm-hmm. Can I come in on this?
Yes, please, Joost. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the Arab states, not just Jordan, but also Saudi Arabia, which shut down a couple of flying things, and the other Arab states don't want to be part of any anti-Iran alliance that Israel might try to cobble together with the United States. This is not what they want, but they are afraid of Iran. They certainly don't want anything coming from Iran or from Israel flying and violating their airspace. So they will shoot at it. But it's a really problematic, difficult issue for them, because they I think they prefer to keep Iran close somehow, and to have good diplomatic relations with Iran. And we have seen in the last 3-4 years that the Emirates and Saudi Arabia have restarted their diplomatic relations with Iran. But they don't want to be seen to be hostile to Iran. At the same time, so when Iran fires rockets and they overfly Jordan or Saudi Arabia, you know, it's their sovereign right to shoot them down. And I think the Jordanians have said that, in fact, we did not support Israel. Now, it looks like they did, but for the public discourse, they're making clear, you know, and to appease the Jordanians, not just the Palestinians, but the entire Jordanian population, that, you know, that to appease them, they said, okay, we did this in order to protect our airspace. I think in the Saudi case, that was clear, because Saudi Arabia doesn't have a peace treaty or any diplomatic relations with Israel, so it's in a different position anyway. But it's a very, very difficult predicament for these states.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you a crucial question. Where this tit-for-tat campaign to escalate, we are talking about a highly nuclear-armed country in Israel, and Iran, which has been trying to become nuclear, and I don't know to what degree it has succeeded or not, but the thought of it escalating into that, and we know there are some people in the current Israeli government who have called to nuke Gaza, and I think they probably mean it. What might happen, God forbid, if we get to that state, Joost?
So two things. One is, Iran doesn't have breakout capability yet, but is very close to it, and it could move to that really at short notice. But it is not clear to, and not close to weaponizing. So it couldn't load a nuclear device yet on any missile and then deliver that. So, so an actual nuclear conflict between Iran and Israel is still some time off. I say that with great delight, but
hopefully a long time off or never off.
Yeah, it could be.
Never
on. It's a terrible prospect. It's a terrible prospect. But the other thing is that, you know, if you say, you know, we see this escalation going forward, maybe now they are de-escalating at this very moment, maybe. But you know, the future could again, we could have another incident like this. What is happening is the war in Gaza is stirring this, and the broader Israel-Palestine conflict and the fact that it is not resolved is driving this. And so I think as a first step, you mentioned early on, ST, in the program, you said you were one of the first people to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. I mean, it's absolutely critical. I mean, I met recently with Hamas leaders in Doha. I met with Hezbollah leaders in Beirut. So, you don't have to take them at face value, but they make very clear that if the war in Gaza ends, they will go back to their posture of before October 7th of 2023, which is not the best, but it's certainly a lot less violent and tense than it is now. And then you can go back to some kind of negotiations. And I think in the end, what these recent events have shown is that the Israel-Palestine conflict remains the core conflict in the Middle East, and maybe the world, that can really set everything aflame.
Right, yeah. My guests are Joost Hilterman. He is the program director for the International Crisis Group Middle East and North Africa, and he's talking to us from Iraq. And also with us is Richard Silverstein, independent journalist who reports on Israeli national security affairs, including the Israel-Palestine and Israel-Iran conflict. And you can read what he writes in the Tikkun Olam blog. Tikkun Olam, do you want to tell Richard what that means? And also if there's anything you want to add to what Yos just said.
Tikkun Olam is a phrase from the Talmud that translates literally
the Jewish,
as repairing. Jewish book of laws, an ancient book based on the Old Testament. So it translates as repair the world. And it originally had a more religious context, but lately in the past few decades, it's come to mean literally repairing the world through social justice, anti-war activism, and related matters. So that's why I took that name for my blog. In terms of the question that you asked, I think that, as I mentioned, we're in very dangerous territory right now. Netanyahu really broke all limits by attacking the Iranian consulate in Damascus, which is sovereign Iranian territory, and also killed one of the most senior IRG generals in that attack. So Netanyahu has proven more than willing to escalate this conflict. And given that we have the most right-wing and even fascist government in Israel's history, and you have people like Itamar Ben-Gvir, who you mentioned, and Bezalel Smotrich, who are themselves former Jewish terrorists and are extremely radical and extremely militarist in terms of their approach to this. I think that I use the term precipice. And so any, as you said, any mistake, anything can be a match that lights a tinderbox. And for people who are interested in history, if we go back to the last century, in World War I, an entire world war was caused by the assassination by two Serbian nationalists of the Archduke of Austria-Hungary. So that kind of escalation, which is exactly what the Israelis did in Damascus, can set the entire region aflame. And thankfully, this particular incident has resolved itself. The Iranians don't want to continue the tit for tat, and so we are calming everything down. But we still have Gaza. We still have Hezbollah launching rockets and attacks in northern Israel. So this is by no means contained.
Yeah, and I would like to invite our listeners to join the conversation if you have relevant questions or comments. 608-256-2001, extension 1. You can join us on social media at War Talk on X or Twitter, however you want to call it, or a public affair on Facebook. And we did get a question from a listener, and Barbara, I'll get to it soon, because we are actually going to move to Gaza right now, and we'll get to your question soon, as I said. So according to Yaakov Amidror, he's a former advisor to Netanyahu. He said that Netanyahu may be positioning himself to tell Biden that he, or I think by now he probably has told Biden, that he will refrain from striking back at Iran, but what we want in return is that America will give Israel all the help needed to escalate attacks on Palestinians, including in Rafah. And I wonder what you, our guests, know about it or think about it. Let's start with you, Joost.
Yeah, I've heard that report. I'm not sure it is true, but it may be that there is a quid pro quo. Because, in fact, the Israeli counterattack on Iran was very limited, and so you can imagine that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu would want to extract some concessions from the Americans. In this case, the green light for a ground offensive on Rafah, which he has long threatened, of course, and that has been postponed. So, and he would want to attack Rafah because it seems that the remaining Hamas battalions and leadership are somewhere in tunnels underneath Rafah. So this has been a long-standing objective. In the past, in the not-so-distant past, the United States said, well, if you're going to carry out such an offensive, you have to make the proper provisions for the population, which is now almost 2 million in the south, maybe a bit less, most of them displaced from the north. Where are they going to go? And the Israelis have not presented any kind of plan for that. And in any case, it is very difficult to see how there could be a plan because the Gaza is destroyed, utterly destroyed. Where can they go? It's not clear. So that has been blocking any effort by the Israelis to go into Rafah because the Americans basically said it's a no-go. Now, it could happen, but I think if you look at the language that the sides are using, they seem to be aiming for not a full-scale ground offensive on Rafah, but something that is a bit more precise, maybe. But one way or another, with so many people in such a small area, it's going to be a humanitarian disaster on top of what is already a famine.
Mm-hmm. Richard, what are your thoughts about that? And the notion, perhaps we can add here, that all of these are, in a sense, gifts to Netanyahu, because as long as he's a prime minister, he is not in prison for corruption. And as long as there's wars and attacks and so on and so forth, it seems, will remain the prime minister despite the majority of Israelis wanting him to stop being the prime minister. So what do you think?
Well, Netanyahu's interest is in continuing in power. That's his primary interest among all things, unlike most leaders who have a political agenda and perhaps a strategic vision for their country. Netanyahu is a narcissist, megalomaniac, and only preserving his own self from the corruption charges and maintaining power. Those are his primary interests. So having a war in Gaza, having unrest in the West Bank, attacking the Iranian consulate is all part of the plan. I don't know if it's an organized plan, but it's, improvised plan to keep the kettle boiling in the Middle East. And as long as that happens, unrest within Israel, a political dissent and all the rallies that happen are really tamped down because Israelis don't like to protest against their government when it's at war. So it's really a clever strategy, and Netanyahu is a very clever political tactician. I think that it's in his interest to do that. Now, the attack on Rafah could happen. I think Joost was right. It could be a more precise attack. But we have to remember that Netanyahu is essentially ignored Biden in all of the military operations in Gaza up until now. Biden has made these noises saying we want Israel to take into account humanitarian needs of uninvolved civilians. Israel has rampantly attacked civilians. It's attacked everyone in Gaza. So whatever the Amidrol, who you mentioned, is a right-wing hawk, former national security advisor, so I don't put a huge amount of credibility. He's basically advancing Netanyahu's messages here and messaging. And I think that Biden himself is constrained because, for example, the United States vetoed a UN Security Council resolution yesterday that would have made Palestine a full member. It would have recommended to the General Assembly that Palestine become a full state and a member of the UN. And we vetoed that resolution. So Biden has generated a huge amount of opposition inside the United States. I would say maybe perhaps nearly a million voters in primaries voted uncommitted rather than voting for him. So he's making noises like, I'm really trying to crack down on the Israelis or restrain the Israelis. But he's basically giving them carte blanche. He's sending $18 billion worth of armaments, 50 new F-15 warplanes to Israel. So as far as I'm concerned, Biden is engaged in theatrics, and he may pay for that because he needs all those voters, all those million voters, to come back to him in November. And it's questionable whether that will happen. And in a very close race with Trump, he could lose partly because of this.
Yeah, and when he pays for it, we will all pay for it too, because we'll have Trump as he himself declared as a dictator, which is not something I'm looking forward to. Okay, so we have a caller, and then we have a question from Barbara. Let's go there. Steve, you're on the air.
Yes, addressing either or both Mr. Silberstein and Hilberman. At this time, is Assad Syria stable enough to be considered an independent sovereign player in the Middle East? What's going on there now? Thank you.
Let's have Joost answer that.
Well, it is still a sovereign player. Syria is recovering from the civil war. But its security apparatus is severely weakened compared to prior to 2011. It enjoys strong support from Russia in particular, and also from Iran. And they don't necessarily have the same agenda, but they agree on keeping Bashar al-Assad in power. And Syria, as long as it's under Bashar al-Assad, will continue to be a channel for Iranian arms to Hezbollah in Lebanon. That's the current situation. So it depends on what you mean with sovereign. Officially, it's sovereign, but de facto, Bashar al-Assad's survival is really much dependent on Russia and Iran.
Mm-hmm. I want to...
And I want to, if I might add,
yeah, go ahead,
Israel,
Richard.
I'm sorry. Israel does attack Syrian targets inside, and they attacked Damascus in yesterday's attack that involved Iran. And so Israel has made hundreds of air attacks on Syrian military targets, which are, as you said, is affiliated with Iran, transshipping missiles to Hezbollah, which have created that 100,000 missile arsenal that Hezbollah has in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. I want to take the opportunity to recommend a movie that I saw just very recently in the Wisconsin Film Festival. It's titled Green Border. It's directed by Agnieszka Holland, who is Polish, and it's about the border between Belarus and Poland. And the main characters, there are a family from Syria who were finally able to escape from the horrors that they've suffered in that country, and also an encounter with ISIS. And they believed Lukashenko, the prime minister or the president of Belarus, when he said that he would welcome refugees there. And so they go there trying to get into Poland so that they can get to Sweden. And then it's a very realistic depiction of just terrible things that are happening, still happening on that border. Very few people watch that movie for some reason, and I would love many more to to watch it. It's titled Green Border. So let's get back to Barbara's question, which is, can you clarify the status of Palestinian prisoners? We hear of Israeli hostages, but why are Palestinian prisoners not being called hostages? You know, I've been thinking that too. Aren't they hostages? Richard, let's start with you.
Yes, definitely they're hostages. In fact, there was a ceasefire earlier in this conflict, and there was an exchange of prisoners, and Palestinian prisoners were released. And however, Israel just then arrested more than the number that they released. So, this is definitely a political situation. Taking of hostages is not just a happenstance. It's part of the balance of power between these two forces. So going back to the Israeli hostages, Hamas on 10/7 took 250 Israelis hostage. Many of them, by the way, were military, so I would call them captives rather than hostages. However, many of them have been killed by Israel, by the way, in its attacks on Gaza and Gaza civilians. And attacks in the tunnels where the hostages are being kept. So there was talk about Hamas being asked to release 40 hostages in a future ceasefire deal. And Hamas replied, we may not have 40 live hostages. Mm. So this war has killed Israeli hostages, and Netanyahu doesn't really care. He makes noises about the hostages, but he doesn't really engage in any kind of empathic or interaction with the hostage families, who are very angry, by the way, and protesting inside the Knesset and interrupting the legislative activity in the Knesset. The hostage families are extremely angry at the government, and Netanyahu has basically abandoned the hostages because he doesn't want a ceasefire for reasons I mentioned earlier. He doesn't want the hostages returned. I mean, if he could get them back without making any concessions, he would. But he is refusing in the negotiations so far for a hostage deal that hasn't happened and a ceasefire. He's refusing to allow Gazans to return to their homes in northern Gaza. So that's a key demand by Hamas, and he's refused. And that's why, as you said, ceasefire is not in the cards right now.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also important to note that the hostages, the people who were taken from the kibbutzim mostly, they are left wingers, and as such, they really are of no consequence to Netanyahu. Maybe the opposite, and he's basically allowing them to get killed by Israel's bomb and Israel's starvation and dehydration and the lack of medicine and so on and so forth. We have another caller and not much time, so I'd like to get back to the phone. Hello, Maurice. Oh, he's not online. Okay, so he commented that he thinks it's not possible for Trump to become president, pointing to the trials and him appearing to be run down. Well, I would like to be as optimistic as you, Maurice. I don't know about that. But again, we have very little time, so we're going to continue talking about our issues here. Yost, Israel's defense minister has called for a war against Hezbollah, which is in Lebanon, not near Gaza. Why is that? What is that about?
Well, since October 7th, when Hamas attacked the Israeli communities ringing the besieged Gaza Strip, Hezbollah has fired rockets into Israel, as well as into the occupied Golan Heights. And the impact of that has been that 80,000 or more Israeli civilians have had to be evacuated from northern towns along the border with Lebanon. Actually, a similar number of Lebanese civilians have been forced to leave the border towns in southern Lebanon as well. So we're talking about another huge humanitarian problem. In a way, I mean, people are put up in hotels and other places, so they're not starving like in Gaza. But anyway, they're not at home, and it's been 6 months. So it's a real problem, and Israel wants to, from its perspective, to fix that. You know, there's two ways to go about it. One is military, the other one is political slash diplomatic. And I know that the Americans are trying to mediate and are trying to find a way to reestablish the arrangement that existed before October 7th through UN Security Council resolution and other mechanisms. But I think if that doesn't work, the Israelis are saying, then they will have to attack. Maybe, you know, they used the term mow the lawn in Gaza before October 7th. They want to do the same in Lebanon. They know they cannot destroy Hezbollah, but they can certainly cut it down to a certain size, and in the process destroy much of Lebanon. We saw it in 2006. We may see it again this year or next. And so that is definitely part of the debate.
But Hezbollah is much stronger than Hamas, isn't it?
If I might interject here, yeah, Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, actually on 10-7 or 10-8, told the cabinet that he didn't want to immediately attack Hamas in Gaza. He actually wanted to attack Hezbollah because, as you just mentioned, that Hezbollah is a far more potent enemy than Hamas in Gaza. Gaza isn't capable of mounting the same kind of resistance and attack and offensive capability. It did fire hundreds of missiles and rockets on 10-7, but Hezbollah, as I said, had the 100,000 missiles, and the cabinet overrode Gallant, but he expects that there will be a major confrontation with Hezbollah, and he wanted to beat them before dealing with Hamas. So it is, other than Iran, Hezbollah is the second most potent enemy that Israel faces.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have only 3 minutes left, and I also have a message on my computer here that my battery is running low. Hopefully I will still be here in 3 more minutes, but let me ask you, Richard, the ICC, is, we are hearing, going to issue arrest warrants against, Israel's senior political and military leadership, including Netanyahu himself and some senior IDF commanders responsible for the Gaza genocide. What can you tell us about that?
Well, an Israeli reporter for Channel 12 TV said that he had received information from a source that the ICC planned to issue arrest warrants for Netanyahu and for the senior military command, and that they planned to do this before the end of May. So if that's the case, that really ratchets up pressure on the Israelis. It turns Israel into even more of a pariah state than it is now. And it gives ammunition, it gives credibility to opponents of Israel, and it makes Israel's allies, the European states and the U.S., sort of being accessories, not just to the genocide as they are, but they're making their alliance with a state. By the way, there has not been any indictment or conviction in the International Court of any European or Western democracy. Mm-hmm. So other than Serbia, which I don't put in that category, I think that this would be the first. And there's been a lot of criticism of the ICC as being pro-Western biased. Yeah. So this also is a new precedent that would be set.
Yeah. Joost, we have a minute. Your last words of wisdom to our listeners.
Well, you know, we come back to the need for an urgent need for a ceasefire. In fact, it's long overdue. And Israeli leadership would argue that to agree to a ceasefire now would be a gift to Hamas. And maybe it is. You can look at it that way. But what is the cost? We're looking at famine in Gaza, mass destruction in Gaza, possibly displacement beyond the Gazan borders. So is it worth it? Can the Western allies of Israel support this notion? Somehow that it seems to me really perverse. So the need for a ceasefire is absolute.
Yes. Well, Joost Hilterman, Program Director of International Crisis Group Middle East and North Africa, and Richard Silverstein, you can read his writings at the Tikkun Olam blog. Thank you both very much. I really appreciate you joining us today. Bye-bye. And thanks to Samuel and Jade. I'm Esti Dinor. We'll be talking again next week. Bye-bye. Recorded with information that would never WORT be reported. Madison. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen. Wow! I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good. So good. I got a year. Nice. A sugar and spice. I feel nice. A sugar and spice. So nice. So nice. I got you.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the Mel and Floyd Summer Replacement Show. I'm Mel. Floyd is on assignment, but with us, as always, the man who knows everything, Mr. Smarty Pants.
You darn tootin'. You varmint.
Oh, he's gonna lay down some truth today.
Oh, man. Don't you just hate that? They call them truths. I mean, could anything be more egregious? Less humble. Yeah, everything comes out of my mouth is a truth. Yeah.
And then when they like retweet them, they say they're retruthing them or something.
Yeah, well, yeah. Kind of. Did you hear that thing about the NPR guy that was, he was slagging on NPR? There was like, they looked into the things he was complaining about that he had, you know, he basically, so he was a guy on NPR and he,